Hello, fellow realists. I'm David Ravel, and this is ValueSide Weekend for May 14 and 15. For all of our articles and podcasts, visit valueside.com. Well, this weekend, Twitter on hold, inflation eases, and the market catches their breath. Elon Musk, the peripatetic billionaire investor, philanthropist, and co-founder of Tesla Motors, has put his acquisition on Twitter on hold. This after Reuters reported that a substantial number of Twitter accounts may be bots. Fake people, not real. Reuters reported that the number of fakes may be as high as 5%. Musk wants to make sure. So the entire deal is on hold, pending Musk's investigation of Twitter. Meanwhile, Twitter stock on Friday dropped roughly 10% on the news. This raised a number of questions for Twitter going forward. It was rumored that a number of employees were on the chopping block should Musk buy the company. In fact, many may have already left. And just what their status is after all of this is still up in the air. And then there's that matter of the former president, Donald Trump. Twitter founder Jack Dorsey went on record saying that he thought Trump should be brought back on board Twitter, a position that Musk has long advocated. Where that stands now is also unknown. Now, in other news this week, two major measures of inflation eased somewhat, as both the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, and the Producer Price Index, the PPI, both eased. CPI coming in down 3 ticks, to still a very robust 8.3% annual inflation rate, and the producer prices down 5 ticks to 11% annual rate. It all seems to me more like a pause in the action rather than any real change in direction for inflation. There is simply no getting around the fact that inflation remains way too high, elevated, as the Federal Reserve likes to say, and I see nothing here that says we're getting inflation under control anytime soon. Now, the same sort of observation could be made about these markets. In spite of a nice catch-your-breath rally on Friday, by all measures, this market looks weak. This week, all three major indexes, the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, all down more than 2%, as it appears that equities simply want to grind lower. So grab a cup of coffee and let's look back on this eventful week as we take a look back at the week just passed. Well, Mother's Day. It's a traditional get-together for our family. As I'm not a good cook, my responsibility is to bring the wine for the festivities. Having grown up in California, it's assumed that I know something about the fruit of the vine. An assumption that may not be fully justified. So off I go to the local wine shop, all state-run here in Pennsylvania, you know. I'm prepared for the higher prices I'm likely to see here. Inflation, it's everywhere, you know. Now, I don't buy many bottles, only around the holidays, and I have just a small selection that we all seem to like. So it really is a pretty good sample of how prices, or at least wine prices, are in this part of the country. And it turns out to be a big surprise. Prices were most definitely not higher. In fact, many bottles were on sale, and the ones that weren't were, if anything, a little bit lower than I remember. But how can this be? Inflation is everywhere, we're told. So I started to look around. The first thing I noticed was that Zero Hedge is reporting that used car prices are crashing, falling at the same rate they were going higher last summer. Now, certainly, we've not moved away from an inflation base, at least not yet, but they are starting to appear indications that inflation may not be as long-lasting as you and I thought. Case in point, we have two measures of price at the producer level last week, one for manufacturing and one for non-manufacturing. The first, the manufacturing producer prices, showed that they are actually starting to decline, while non-manufacturing continues its rise, showing that inflation continues for non-manufacturing but might be slowing for the manufacturing sector of the economy. The same story was told in oil last week. While here in America, oil prices continue higher, That's inflation. I note that Saudi Arabia just cut their oil prices over the weekend, indicating perhaps that this all-important commodity may be starting to see an easing in its price inflation. And as analysts, that's just the sort of thing we're looking for, the trend before they are fully developed. We're looking around the corner for the next phase in the financial markets. It's the discounting mechanism in operation. That's what markets do. They discount future revenue and earnings, trying to estimate what any given investment will return over time. Which brings us to the most important indicator of all, an indicator that seems to be pointing to an end of inflation, ironically. And those indicators are the financial markets themselves. Now, the destruction of wealth that has occurred over the past few weeks has been incredible. This past week alone saw the market leaders, the top five stocks, fall 10% collectively, with equities in general experiencing the worst week in 11 years, and bonds were certainly not immune, falling at the greatest rate in over 50 years. All in all, it was one of the worst performances in a generation. And most certainly a reverse wealth effect. Now, the wealth effect is the condition that consumers experience when their basic assets are appreciating. People tend to spend more when they feel they're becoming wealthier. But we're on the opposite track right now. Can you say poverty effect? Which it seems to me will translate into demand destruction. As markets fall and people's investments and retirement accounts do likewise, it seems reasonable to assume that their spending patterns will also fall. And that's why, at some point, I'm looking for ultimately lower, not higher, prices ahead. From President George H.W. Bush 30 years ago, to Klaus Schwab today, the mantra of Western national leaders has been a march toward a new world order, where, to quote H.W., the rule of law, not the rule of the jungle, will prevail. It was a vision that seamlessly slipped into a one-world government, a government, no doubt, led by those selfsame Western leaders. But as the new century unfolds, it becomes increasingly apparent that these new world leaders have failed to check on that part of the globe that lies beyond the international dateline. Because it's on that side of the world that comes most of the adamant resistance for this new world order. And if there is one thing that we've learned from both Russia and China, they have a very different vision of just how this world should evolve. It seems as if with each day comes a new revelation of just how either Russia or China is asserting their own sovereignty, a sovereignty which has little or nothing to do with those new world powers to their west. The military incursion, their word, in Ukraine is the obvious example number one, but so too is the move to sell Russian oil and gas in rubles, not dollars, the move by the Chinese to counter the SWIFT settlement system with their own system, the continued pronouncements by the Chinese that Taiwan is but a wayward province of the mainland. And so it goes. But from an economic perspective, one of the major moves by Beijing came on Friday, when it was announced that the PRC would now require all state-run computers to be made only in China. This is an in-your-face rebuke of one of the few markets where America still holds dominance, high technology. While the U.S. lost manufacturing dominance years ago, and today is forced to purchase many of the goods and services we rely on from overseas producers, can you say supply chain? One of the few areas we could claim some sort of competitive advantage was in the companies like Apple Computer, Microsoft, and all the rest. At least, we still had leading-edge software and information technology. But not anymore, says Xi Jinping. And worse, this move takes away that billion-population Chinese market, the one that American multinationals have been lusting after for as long as I can remember. Literally billions have been spent and trade secrets compromised just on the elusive promise that one day Americans would be able to sell to the Chinese. Well, Friday put a lie to that fantasy, or at least it should have. Hello, West Coast America, from Silicon Valley to Richmond, Washington. Do you get it yet? China is going their own way, unwinding from the globalist dream. It should be clear to all that China feels they no longer need America. In fact, if anything, it may be the other way around, that America needs China. The Chinese clearly feel that they now possess, by hook or crook, sufficient technological know-how to go out on their own. This move is a huge vote of confidence for the Chinese PC makers, companies like Acer, Lenovo, or Asus. In short, China has rolled back the clock 50 years. They've tried the open-door policy initiated by President Nixon back in the 1970s. They've gained all the knowledge and all the trade secrets the West could provide. Now it's China that will call the shots. It's a new world order, all right, but not the one that Nixon, Bush, or Schwab imagined. It's been just 1 year, 3 months, and 21 days since Joseph Robinette Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. And yet, it's almost a certainty that he will go down as one of the most consequential presidents in our history. Consequential, not just for what he's done, but for many of the circumstances and events which surround his presidency. Now, when he ran for president back in 2020, Biden spelled out a very specific and detailed plan in dealing with the oil, gas, and coal industries. It was clear from the very beginning of his campaign that he was going to reduce this nation's reliance on fossil fuels. And as any seasoned observer will note, Biden's campaign against fossil fuels has been perhaps the most successful single policy of his administration. At a campaign stop back in early February of 2020, Biden stated bluntly that we're going to get rid of fossil fuels, unquote. Later in that same campaign stop, when asked about the executives who ran the large oil companies, Biden said, quote, we should put them all in jail, unquote. This was a campaign run on the premise that the principal danger facing this country is anthropomorphic global warming. And as the chief champion in this fight against global warming, Biden was going to go all out in his fight against fossil fuels in general and the oil and gas industry in particular. And that's exactly what he's done. As the Washington Post pointed out in an article written the week of Biden's inauguration, Biden set out in his term by cutting back on new leases in federal lands, challenging the depletion allowance, canceling the Keystone Pipeline Project, seeking to penalize any methane released by oil producers or pipelines, seeking to curtail the use of fracking, and encouraging the use of electric vehicles. In short, President Biden has followed through on all of his campaign promises in terms of energy. He's brought the country to exactly where he promised. It's no accident, and it's a consequence of a well-thought-out, long-standing policy by candidate and now President Biden. It's also been a policy that has produced dramatically higher prices for energy and transportation, one of the chief drivers of this inflation that we're all suffering through. The other principal driver, from my perspective, would be the incredible stimulus program initiated at the end of the pandemic, but we'll leave that for another day. Now, the Bureau of Economic Statistics, which in just a few minutes will release their latest calculation on inflation, tells us that the price of energy during the last 12 months is up an incredible 30%. Nothing else in their inflation formula comes even close. No other indicator outside of oil, gas, and coal is up as much as 10%. And this is why I call Biden's presidency one of the most consequential in our history. Joe Biden is obviously someone who sets off to do something and then does it. Unfortunately, in terms of energy policy, he's been wildly successful, and his success may put us all in the poorhouse. Well, at 8:30 yesterday morning, The latest report on inflation at the consumer level was flashed across every terminal in Wall Street. This morning, again at 8:30, we'll get the report on inflation at the producer or wholesale level. And like yesterday's report, analysts expect that it too will show a lower level of inflation. And like yesterday, many will guess just how these two reports will translate into the Fed's monetary policy. For most, it was a simple equation of lower inflation, less tightening by the Fed. But I suspect that things won't be quite that easy when all is said and done. For one thing, this is an especially difficult time to judge just what is the trending inflation in the country. Now, last Wednesday, the Federal Open Market Committee released their statement on their latest meeting. And in that important opening paragraph, they make several points that are especially pertinent to inflation. The very first sentence begins in part, "Overall economic activity edged down in the first quarter." And that's critical. Essentially, this mitigates against the Fed's over-tightening, against the Fed raising rates too far and slowing the economy too much. Now, later in that same release, the Fed gave three causes for inflation as they see it. Overall imbalances in supply and demand relating to lingering effects of the pandemic, and I would add, lingering effects of the economic lockdown. Second, they see higher energy prices contributing to inflation, and finally, broader overall price pressure. So let's look at these one by one. As for the pandemic, it's pretty much history now, at least I hope so, and there's very little the Fed can do about the economic ramifications of the pandemic anyway. So rule this one out as out of the Fed's playing field. It is simply what it is. As for higher energy prices, again, as long as the Fed is not drilling oil wells, really, it too is out of the Fed's field. Finally, as to broader price pressure. Aha, this is what we're looking for, and this is what the Fed can do something about. Raising interest rates will likely reduce overall demand pressure. So it's one out of three areas that the Fed's monetary policy will have a significant impact on inflation. And that area is demand pressure. Now let's look at how inflation is trending currently from the Fed's point of view. I think there's every indication that the Fed saw March as the top of the mountain. That is, it was in March that we saw the most elevated point of inflation. And the CPI report yesterday, combined with what's likely going to be today's producer price inflation, will probably bear this out. And I say this because later on in that same Fed statement, they then say, quote, "The committee expects inflation to return to its 2% objective." Wow. That lays down the benchmark upon which I believe the Fed wants to be measured. It's almost saying, relax, guys. Remember that 2% inflation we saw earlier last year? Well, it'll be here again. And this makes sense if you think that much of inflation that we're seeing right now is the residue from that incredible money pumping that was done at the end of the pandemic, particularly those corporate and individual stimulus checks. And as we finish up April, it seems that the Fed's optimism is indeed panning out. Remember, this Fed statement was written almost 2 months ago. And in the meantime, we've seen that terrible March report that showed inflation topping at 8.5%. But for the Fed, it must have looked even worse. You see, the Fed has a favorite measure of inflation based on personal consumption expenditures, and each month the Dallas branch provides a supplemental report to the PCE. The Dallas report just released showed March inflation ballooning up to almost 11% on a 12-month basis. And that would have been a nightmare. I have to believe that when Dallas prepares their April report, it will be well below that 11% level. So while everyone, and most especially the Fed, realizes that 1 month does not make a trend, and the fact that April is showing less inflation than March is certainly not definitive, at least it's a step in the right direction. This, combined with the Fed's willingness to remind us of its overall long-term target of 2% inflation, leads me to believe that the Fed is looking for a brighter inflation picture ahead. At least, Let's hope so. American presidential politics is the most stylized and arcane process in all the world. Anyone seeking to become president must begin their campaign at least 2 and more likely 4 or 5 years before the election. Traveling up and down this country, speaking endlessly to often small crowds in faraway corners of this vast expanse we call America. It is, as we say, a highly stylized series of events, where Democrats speak mainly of social and political equality, while Republicans speak mainly of economic and political freedom. It is, as often repeated, a kabuki theater, highly ideological in its nature. As voters, we want to see someone who, quote, agrees with us, whatever that means. But come the first Tuesday in November, all that changes. Candidate so-and-so becomes president so-and-so. The name currently is Biden. And almost always we see, in their campaign, an ideologue becoming the compromising manager only later when their responsibilities change from winning votes to guiding this far-flung enterprise, which is our country. Some presidents make this transition better than others. Franklin Roosevelt, for instance, seemed adept at both the ideological aspect and the managerial aspect of becoming president. Dwight Eisenhower, to my thinking, was superior as a manager. He had, after all, managed most of World War II, but somewhat deficient as a campaigner. Of recent presidents, I put George H.W. Bush, that's Bush the Senior, in the management category, and Barack Obama in the campaigner category. But no matter how you look at any of the nation's leaders, they all had at least one thing in common. They all desired to manage the country well enough so that they could stand for re-election. They would all, for instance, try to achieve the best economic growth possible, even if that meant compromising on some of their basic campaign promises. Bush Sr.'s campaign's promise of "read my lips, no new taxes" quickly fell away once he was elected. Barack Obama also promised no new middle-class taxes, as well as universal health care coverage, neither promise of which he was kept. It's all part of the difference between campaign visions and management realities. But this all may have changed for the current occupant of the White House. How else do you explain such recent decisions as his move yesterday to cancel all new oil leases in Alaska and in the Gulf of Mexico? The combined leases in Alaska alone contained more than 1 million acres, while the Gulf leases are thought to cover an area rich in both oil and gas. Making this all the more astonishing, Biden has canceled these leases at the very time that U.S. drivers are paying an all-time high for a gallon of gasoline. These prices of gasoline and diesel fuel are almost guaranteed to send this country into a recession, something that would be anathema to the average president. But as we said, Joe Biden is no ordinary president. To anyone Biden's age, and I count myself among his company, he realizes that this is his last hurrah, that what he does now will be his legacy throughout all of history. And so I believe that he has thrown off any pretense of managing the country. Instead, he is guiding the nation as a pure ideologue, saving the beluga whale, lowering the rising sea levels, reducing the carbon emissions. In short, doing all those things not to help the country's economy, which is fading badly, but to uphold the values and visions of those on the left side of the political spectrum. If the result of all this is a horrific recession or worse, and I believe it will be, then so be it, as far as Joe Biden is concerned. If it comes to environmentalism or economic prosperity, I believe Biden has already chosen. And his choice is solidly with the environmentalists. It is, after all, simply the price of being green.
And that's The Value Side for this May 14 and 15 weekend. For all of our podcasts and blog posts, visit valuesign.com. I'm David Revelle. ValueSign is independently written and researched. The views expressed are strictly my own.
Thank you.